The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Thursdays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. One more week has gone by, and we're back in the studio with the News Dissector Radio Hour. For the next hour, we're going to be talking about a lot of different issues, the economy, debt, and others. And we're going to hopefully get some response from you on our call-in line, 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888, a free call, of course. This morning, as we meet, I came to the studio wearing my faded Seeds of Peace shirt. Seeds of Peace, an organization of young people from the Middle East, from Israel, from the Palestinian territories, occupied territories, from Egypt, from other Jordan and other countries, have been essentially attempting over the years to promote peace by getting to know each other, building coexistence, building dialogue between themselves. It's a very impressive group of young people, and I was privileged to make a film about them many years ago when Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat came to Washington. President Clinton singled out the kids from Seeds of Peace on the lawn of the White House and said that they were the most promising model for peace. Well, fast forward, and yesterday in the White House, we had the King of Jordan, the President of Egypt, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority, Mr. Netanyahu from Israel, and President Obama meeting once again to try to talk about peace in the Middle East and peace between Palestine and Israel. And once again, this process is beginning. Supposedly in a year, we'll have some breakthroughs, but don't count on it, don't bet on it, because it hasn't happened in the past. I'm very struck by some comments by Michael Brenner, who teaches at the University of Pittsburgh, talking about what's actually happening. And he says, it is nonsensical to think that anything close to a meaningful agreement and stable settlement can emerge from current conditions. Let's remind ourselves of its cardinal features. An ultra-nationalist Israeli government, headed by an avowed opponent of any serious concessions, on whose side is foreign minister and governmental number two, Avigdor Lieberman, who's been described as a Jewish fascist by the most honest and astute of the Israeli commentators, Yuri Avneri. That's one count. An American president who's been humiliated repeatedly and personally by Netanyahu, who holds over his head the drawn sword of the Israeli lobby. Obama was stared down on the settlements, cowed into submission, to the point where he reflexively swallowed whole and publicly parroted word by word the Jerusalem spin on the Gaza flotilla affair. Says our friend here, Michael Brenner, forget it. Don't think anything serious is going to happen. Time magazine has a story, which is in some ways even more disturbing. Why Israel doesn't care about peace. Listen to this. The people don't believe. People in Israel are indifferent. They don't care if there's going to be war. They don't care if there's going to be peace. They don't care. They live in the day. The truth is, Israelis are no longer preoccupied with the matter. They're otherwise engaged. They're making money. They're enjoying the rays of late summer. A watching world may still define the country by the blood feud with the Arabs whose families used to live on this land, and whether that conflict can be negotiated away. But Israelis say they have moved on. So we've gone from, in a sense, engagement to indifference, and with the passions all being transferred over to a very well-financed lobby that is out there to ensure that nothing happens that will in any way put terms that Israel doesn't want to live with on the Israeli government and the Israeli people, who continue to enjoy, you know, $3 billion plus dollars from the United States, and, you know, a situation which remains, in a sense, the center, the sore at the center of the whole conflict with the Islamic world. So that's what's happening today. We're also I have some economic thoughts to share with you a little bit later. But first, we're going to introduce our guests, the first of whom is Thomas Gagin, who ran for the 5th Congressional District in Illinois against Rahm Emanuel. and said, he says, never have things been words, but never have things been more hopeful. Public policy is up for grabs, he said then. What's happened since? We'll ask him in a minute. Welcome to News Dissector Radio.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we
And with that, a music chronicling the moment we're in, that's the theme song of my film, In Debt We Trust, we welcome Sherry Welch, the dissectress, to join me on the program this morning, and Thomas Gagin. Thomas, so glad that you could join us today as we look at a government that said they narrowly averted a depression, while others fear that another depression is in the cards, or quite possible, a double dip, recession, all this language, which just suggests that things are going to get worse. Do you have any cheery optimism to share with us in that regard?
Danny, I wrote this book, Were You Born on the Wrong Continent, because I think there are a lot of policies that are in place in social democratic countries that would be very useful for us. The number one exporter of the world right now, which is what the U.S. has got to come back as, is a highly unionized, high wage, highly regulated Germany, which has been either the number one exporter in the world or tied for it with China over the last 10 years, and doing it with 82 million people who take 7 weeks off in this, for vacations and even more on holidays, and seem to be doing it with one hand tied behind their back.
Let's repeat that and underline that thought. 7 weeks of paid vacation every year in France, in Germany, in other parts of Europe. In fact, there was a protest.
Typically.
There was a protest in Denmark some years back, a national strike demanding another week. So, you know, this is something where people there seem to recognize the importance of leisure, the importance of not working all the time, and, you know, having a decent standard of living, and yet at the same time, this model that we've seen, successful model of kind of successful, let's qualify it a bit, you know, is sort of been rejected in the United States, which has also rejected some of the financial regulations proposed by the Europeans to try to stabilize the economy. And, you know, here we have a situation where Europe itself is at somewhat at risk today because of this continuing financial crisis. The spillover from Greece and Spain has its highest unemployment ever.
Well, some of Europe is at risk and some isn't. I mean, there are the good countries and bad countries. So the older social democratic countries and the so-called New Europe that Donald Rumsfeld touted back in the Iraq War, it's the New Europe that's in trouble, not the old Europe. The old Europe is in trouble only to the extent that it has to bail out the New Europe. And even there, it's not really in trouble. You know, of late, even people like David Brooks in the New York Times, he wrote a column about a week ago, in a very velvet and indirect way touting the German model, because they are so obviously doing something right that we're not doing. What are they doing that they aren't doing, we aren't doing? They're selling in the world economy. They sell to China. They make money off of China. China doesn't make money off of them. You know, Canada runs a big trade surplus with the U.S., with manufactured goods, et cetera. Canada, believe it or not, is running a trade deficit even with Germany. So it's what are they doing right? Because to bring back full employment here, we've got really one and one only option, and that is we can't increase consumer sales. Consumers are tapped out here. The government can't spend more because the government is horrendously in debt and getting more in debt all the time. So what's the answer out? of this? The answer is to do what other countries do in Central Europe. You sell abroad, exports. People buy your stuff. You don't run a big trade deficit like the U.S. How do you do that? You've got to keep a manufacturing base. How do you do that? Well, look to Germany and France. The unions and the fact that workers have some control over the allocation of capital there, at least through their representation on corporate boards and so forth, has a lot to do with that.
Doesn't the fact that these countries are not spending as much money on war, on military intervention, on gigantic intelligence apparatuses and all the rest of that, also give them more money domestically to invest in their own economies, whereas the United States is spending trillions of dollars, seems
no,
like forever.
No, I disagree.
You disagree totally? How is
completely.
That?
If anything, I think, first of all, let me make one thing clear for all your listeners. I'm not in favor of the military state that we have here, and we do have one. It's bad. We shouldn't have it. We should take it down. But is it hurting us economically? Is that the reason why we're not a social democracy? No. If anything, it's the opposite. You know, to the extent that the U.S. is exporting anything, it's exporting arms. At least it's kind of an industry that we have. If we didn't have the military budget, I think everything in the United States would be a casino. It would be all Wall Street. So,
well, clearly,
Danny, let me finish. The Germans spend a lot more. You know, we pride ourselves as Americans. Oh, we're spending all this money around the world, et cetera, et cetera. Come on. You know, our foreign aid is small. You know, the military budget is something like 4 to 5% of the GDP. Look at what the Germans spend on healthcare in a very efficient system. It's something like 10 to 11% of the GDP. Look at what the United States spends without covering people. It's almost 17% of the GDP. If the United States had an efficient delivery of healthcare system, it would have more than enough money to provide a European-type welfare state and have a military budget. I would not blame. I've got all sorts of problems with the militarization of the United States, big problems. But if people on the left are coming up and shrugging their shoulders and saying, oh, well, we can't do anything because we've got a military budget, that's just wrong.
Well, I'm not saying that. And you know, I'm not saying we can't do anything. We could do a lot. But, you know, doing a lot requires, first of all, leadership. It requires some sort of real discourse and debate about what others are doing right and what we're not doing right. It requires, a political institutions that are functional, not dysfunctional. And taken over by this sort of stalemate polarization politics that now prevents anything from getting done.
And it requires a labor movement. You know, that's the difference between France and Germany, and that's why those things that you mentioned are missing here. There's no labor movement here, and there's American workers are very quiescent and take, I'm a labor lawyer. I do union side work. And the people who are in unions are more heroic here because they put up with a lot more to stay in unions here than they do in Europe. But, you know, the labor union leadership here is wanting in many ways. The level of resignation here and political quietism here is very disturbing. Why are people working longer and longer hours every year without any kind of serious protest at all? You know, it does take a little courage. And you know, one of the things that has been missing in the left debate and the disenchantment with Obama is self-examination. You know, why is there no movement pushing him? It's baffling to me.
Well, now you're singing from my prayer book here. Sherry, are you with us? And would you like
absolutely?
Would you like to join us?
Absolutely. You, just so that people understand, you ran for the Illinois 5th Congressional District seat that was vacant because Rahm Emanuel became the chief of staff.
Yes.
And you know that Rahm Emanuel has been quoted as saying, "Screw the UAW," and I want to get back to the fact that you oppose the bank bailout. You believe that we the people can use the government to do radical things for the working people.
Yes.
And that there was no money for this, there was no money for that,
yes.
You said. But it turns out now there was money for everything. So my question for you are a couple.
Oh, there's always money for everything.
What happened, and what can we the people do to grab it and shape it? I want you to weigh in on roll back the Bush tax cuts, because you wittily quipped, why not just roll back the Reagan tax cuts while we're at it?
Well,
and then
instead
get back to the filibuster.
Instead of talking about what we don't like about the Republicans, because we could talk all day about that and what we think Obama should do and all that, I'd like to focus on what we should do, because we have more control of that. The number one problem with the United States is that there has been no left movement in this country to reform the Senate, and that has been chronic. Not just with Obama recently. It was true under Carter. It was true under Clinton. And it's true under every single Democratic administration has gone down the drain because the Senate has torched absolutely everything that was progressive that came out of the House during those periods of time when the Democrats were in power, every single time. And over the years, I've had all sorts of arguments with friends of mine on the left who say, oh, no, we need the Senate. We've got to keep the Senate in there. We've got to keep the filibuster in there to prevent Republicans from getting onto the courts of appeals and so forth. Well, I appear before those courts of appeals. Unlike my friends, I actually do this for a living. I show up before these judges. I would gladly be before, you know, Janice Brown on the circuit court of blah, blah, blah. Any day of the week, if we could get rid of filibusters and have labor law reform in the country. And until the left focuses on the fact that this, just like progressives did at the turn of the century, they realized their problem was the U.S. Senate, so they pushed through the 17th Amendment. They didn't have a filibuster then. Until the left focuses on changing the constitutional structure of the country as much as it can, and that means primarily reforming the Senate, nothing's going to happen here.
Well, do you see a political environment that's open to that at this point? I mean, given the
I don't even see it on the left. You know, I don't see, even now, there's been some change under Obama, but even now, you know, I have lots of arguments with progressives who want to have government by veto. You know, just let me have my minority veto when the other side gets in. That's all I ask. Well, a movement that is supposed to be majoritarian can't put up with that kind of logic. And until we do that, we aren't going anywhere.
Well, let's look at that a little bit more closely, because, you know, we have a president and a Democratic administration, the White House, Mr. Emanuel and company there, who are sort of resistant to any calls for fundamental change anywhere, it seems.
Nobody's made them. You know, if anybody had gone to Obama at the beginning, you know, I went. Personally, I mean, I went up and down. I don't know if I should tell tales out of school. I don't have any clout. But I went up and down to every friend I had at the AFL-CIO at the beginning of the Obama administration and said, you've got to do something about the filibuster. The response I got, oh, no, we don't have it. We're going to get the 60 votes. Don't worry. Well, I mean, that's fantasy. And had the labor, you know, if the AFL-CIO, which has everything at stake in the labor law reform movement, isn't going to Obama to say, we want you to get rid of the filibuster, what do you think Obama's going to do?
Well, you
listen
know, point
to us on talk radio, say, do something about it? No.
Point well made, but there seems to be, you know, an organizing culture that's very election-oriented. It's not really about organizing on other issues or putting forth legislative proposals, pretty much. It sort of sticks to supporting what's being proposed, you know, in the Congress and the like. It doesn't, I mean, just, you know, on the same day that Glenn Beck drew hundreds of thousands of people to Washington, and you know, it's understandable in a way how he did it with the power of Fox News, with all these Christian evangelists, etc., and so forth. But there was a march in Detroit, Jesse Jackson and the new president of the UAW, to try to talk about jobs. From what I read, and I could have been wrong about this, they only had a turnout of 5,000 people. In a city that's been devastated factories leaving, closing, jobs disappearing, and the like. What is it about the inability, if you will, of the labor movement to mobilize working people? I mean, we're coming up on Labor Day. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I don't want to pick on one particular march that all sorts of organizing events misfire, and some of them work. Also, the greatest people I know are in the labor movement. And second, I'm in the labor movement. I mean, I've dedicated my life to this. I'm a union side lawyer, and while I've brought some suits against unions for not being democratic, and there are a lot of people in the labor movement who don't like me one bit, there are people in the labor movement who do like me. And I certainly spend my life representing unions and employee groups. So, but there's not much there. You know, it's shrinking all the time. There's fewer and fewer workers. I mean, people in this country don't really regard labor as any kind of answer because it's not around. They have no knowledge of it. They have no experience with it. They don't know what it is. So they don't know what the UAW is.
So I have a question for you, Tom.
Yeah.
How do we, the people, change that? Do you have some concrete ideas, some steps, thoughts, proposals, et cetera?
Well, first, I told you filibuster. The second is that it's time for people who are progressives on this to, how should I say, I don't want to say this too abrasively, work with the labor movement, but I mean really decide that the labor movement is their issue too, and that they have as much stake in it as the people who are the organized heads of organized labor. I said that very ineptly, but it's early in the morning, sorry.
Does this mean that we need to re-release Norma Rae so everybody can get familiarized again with how important the unions are to everybody, whether you're in a union or not? Haven't the unions always led the way for better employment practices and created the middle class?
I would say that progressives at one point in this country led the way to unions rather than, now progressives just sort of stand on the side and, let unions in Washington, D.C. decide what they want to do. I think they've got to take back the labor movement. And by that I mean labor law reform. That's got to be something that is for us, the people, not what organized labor would like, but what the unorganized workers of the country would like. I've been pushing this idea of amending the Civil Rights Act to give people a civil right to join a union and to go out and get their own attorneys if they feel they're being discriminated against at work and bring lawsuits. You know, to open the process up as much as possible, make it more voluntaristic, make it more self-help, break out of this NLRB model, which is really exclusively controlled by management and organized labor as to what gets into the process and what bureaucrats in D.C. decide they're going to do about what plant being unionized or not, and open it up the way we did the civil rights movement.
Well, Tom, it's not so easy for people outside the labor movement to interact with the labor movement. I mean, I've just made
that's for sure.
I've made a film, Plunder, the Crime of Our Time, about the financial crisis as a crime story. I have flooded the AFL-CIO blog, people I knew in the unions. I come out of the Cornell Labor Relations School, Tom. My father and my grandfather were union organizers and union members. So I come out of that whole working class culture. I agree with you totally, but efforts to try to even get a dialogue going, even talk to people about this, seem to be, and I'm fairly articulate, I can't seem to do it. I can't seem to connect and try to say, listen, guys, we've got to broaden what we're doing. We've got to not just fight, why not also fight for a moratorium on foreclosures? Why not try to support the homeowners who are suffering so much,
you know,
and minority youth
always thought,
and everyone
else? It's that way over in Europe, too. I mean, it's just the way the world operates. You know, Robert Michels in Moscow wrote these sociological tracts 150 years ago about the bureaucratization of the labor movement. That always happens. There's no sense, railing about it. It's part of life. But the other side
of life.
You
can't advocate, Tom. You can't on the same. Let me get in here because you said we should do X. And I'm saying to you, it's very hard to do X when nobody responds to you. And your answer to that is there's the iron law of oligarchy. There's all this bureaucratic stratification.
You cut me off before I could finish, Dan.
Well, forgive me. I'm trying to make this a two-way discussion.
That was part one of the answer back to you. And part two, which was I about to give, is that nonetheless, in Europe, the left is much more aware of how much stake it has in the labor movement, and they push for it independently and have their own ideas about how to push for it. Now, this book that I sort of am coming on to try to sell, which is called Were You Born in the Wrong Continent?
We want you to. Okay.
It is kind of about, why is it that there is a labor movement in Germany and places like that. And one of the things that's really interesting is that, on the Christian Democratic side, and to some extent on the socialist side, progressives in both sides of those parties pushed things like works councils and co-determination, electing workers to works councils where management has to make deals with the works councils, which are all employee represented, about when working time starts, when they end, you know, who gets laid off, and et cetera, and co-determination, where you have half the corporate boards made up of workers, half the corporate boards. The unions weren't especially in favor of that, but it's turned out to be the thing that saved the labor movement. The labor unions weren't in favor of it because, well, we don't control this, and blah 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 blah, and it's all in the hands of the workers, and so on and so forth. Well, it's saved the unions, and the unions have an enormously important role still in terms of wage bargaining, and the unions have learned very well how important it is to have these works councils and co-determination. But I can tell you this, what we call worker control over there, works councils, co-determination, it didn't come from the German version of organized labor. They didn't push for it. Progressives pushed for it. And that is the single biggest difference between Germany and us, this degree of worker control that was pushed by the left, not by organized labor. So where is our left?
Well, also, you know, let's not forget that Germany, in the last bunch of years, you know, the Social Democratic Party sort of moved to the right, and you know, the whole country moved towards the Christian Democratic right. It's not like you know, workers' paradise over there. You know, this is a
compared to here, it is workers' paradise, and I say that without any scanting of the fact that there's an increase in poverty, there's an increase in inequality, there's a decline in union bargaining. But there's also the fact that the Social Democrats were in power for most of this period. When you say they moved to the right, yes, they moved to the right. But by our standards, their move to the right, they weren't like Tony Blair. Their move to the right was a move to cut back benefits because of demographic problems, which, you know, like it or not, are pretty serious. It's a declining population there, and they have huge benefits. But they've saved the basic structure. They have enraged people on the links, the far left, which is a group of people who are ex-communists and some people in the trade movement, trade union movement, who are really upset that they can't get more and more benefits the way it happened in the 1970s, and it just can't. It is a period of austerity. You know, on the left, we have periods where we can't push, and then there are periods where we can push. And Germany was in a position in the 1990s and early 2000 where there just wasn't enough capital coming in to float the economy. And part of it was this aversion to manufacturing, but the main reason was that all the smart money was going to London and New York to be put on casinos. I mean, we dragged down the German model and made it harder for them to continue. The left responded over there. And believe me, the SPD is the left. You go into the SPD, this group that you say has moved to the right, and the first
I say I'm the only one that's I'm not the only one that has said this. I mean,
I know there are
I
people
mean, come
over
on.
There who say it.
Yeah,
but you go in there. What do you see when you walk in the lobby? A big picture of Karl Marx. You know, I mean, these people are socialists. They don't say, well, we're sort of semi-socialists, or they say they're socialists.
Well, at least in Europe, you're right about.
My point is that they managed to keep the structure in place. There are more works councils in place than there were 10 years ago, not fewer.
Tom, excuse me, Sherry, Tom, I have to, excuse me, I have to exercise the powers invested in me by the great Oz and, you know, as the news dissector and host of the program. I'm watching a clock as all of us are talking, and we're going to have to come to a break here. I want to thank you so much for coming on. You've raised issues that we can continue to discuss and debate, and I think if folks read your book, they would get a lot more information, you know, just facts and you know, aspects of this that are missing, certainly, in our media. Do you have a website, and can you tell us the title of the book again, who published it, and how to get it?
You know, my name is so hard to spell. It's like having an unlisted, even though I'm in the book, it's like an unlisted number. I have a website. It's www.tomgagan, and if anyone can spell Gagan who's never seen the name before, they must be from a certain county in Ireland. It's G-E-O-G-H-E-G-A-N. But the book is called Were You Born on the Wrong Continent? And I think if you Google in Were You Born on the Wrong Continent, you can find a website and Powell's books and, even the non-union Amazon selling.
And it's also listed on linked on the News Dissector blog today, Danny and Tom.
Okay, well, there you go. Thank you, Tom, for coming on. I'd like
Thank
to continue
you,
this debate. Maybe I can hire you to lobby the AFL-CIO to be a little bit more responsive and supportive of the work we're trying to do to educate the American people about this financial crisis. You're a lawyer. I don't know if you're a lobbyist on the side, but
No.
But we need some help in trying to speak to people there to get them interested in Plunder the Crime of Our Time. Thanks. We're moving on right now. Here's a song from In Debt We Trust. It's called One Must Pay in Spanish.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Peter Roth, the host of Energy Stew, which airs on Thursday nights at 8 p.m. My show interviews fascinating authors, inventors, and researchers of new understandings, techniques, and discoveries that can enhance and transform our lives. What is our potential and how can we fulfill it to the max? To find out, tune in to Energy Stew and Peter Roth at 8 p.m. Thursdays on Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, this is Eric Ofner, your host of the best jazz show on the air on Progressive Radio Network, Eric's Sounds of Jazz. Every Friday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, I play the best jazz ever recorded by Louis, Sidney, Bessie, Billy, and all the others. Remember, Progressive Radio Network, Eric Sounds of Jazz, every Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
That's Plastic Fantastic. It's by the Billionaires. It's on the soundtrack of In Debt We Trust. And it was in the screening of In Debt We Trust in Los Angeles that I met my next guest, Harvey Warren, who's been working very diligently on this whole debt issue, and who joins us this morning to talk a little bit more about his work and a new book that he's written about the whole debt crisis, the debt calamity that we're all here. Hi, Harvey. Welcome. Thanks for joining me.
Hey, Dave. It's good to talk to you again. How you been?
Well, you know, I would say that things have gotten a lot worse, you know,
since we... You'd think that by now it would have gotten better. Oh, my God.
Yeah, since we met. You know, at that time I was talking about debt. Now the debt issue has become a massive issue, but it's been redefined by the right to only focus on government deficits. You know, you'll recall that, you know, Bill Clinton managed to end the deficit basically before he left office, and under George Bush the deficit has skyrocketed. Now Republicans, who didn't say anything when all that was going on, are saying that we can't do anything in terms of a new stimulus, in terms of any kind of economic measures, because they, you know, the deficit is climbing too high, and they don't really look at consumer debt, which is of course central to all of this, and that's the debt that so many of us feel, the pain that we feel, you know, when we're being done by, you know, endless phone calls by various credit card companies or the people they hire, and suffering to try to pay back money that was lent to us, you know, under kind of very loose lending terms that we couldn't often afford. So how do you see this situation now, Harvey?
It's kind of funny. I think when you added the housing crisis into that, and you have a whole lot of people, and, you know, Dr. Manning, who was, you know, very, you know, influential in your movie, is talking extensively now about the housing crisis and about how many millions of people are living in their homes currently without paying their mortgages. And
Living in their cars or living in the street, you know, as well.
Well, that's true, too. But for those folks that are currently living in their homes without paying anything for their mortgage or their rent, when those folks get evicted from those homes, they're going to stop paying their credit cards. And Bob is predicting another huge bubble coming through the economy that's going to create a whole other implosion. I think it's really important that people understand how to prepare to deal with their credit card issues while they still can.
Harvey, you've written a new book about this?
I have indeed. I've written a book called Drop Debt, and it's about surviving credit card hell without bankruptcy. So many people want to do something about their debt. They don't know what to do. They get panicked and trapped in a discussion with collectors who are professional collectors, and they're amateur debtors. They really don't know how to deal with those individuals on the phone. They know a lot of tactics and a lot of approaches to get money out of you, and you're sitting there as a amateur debtor, first time in your life that you've been in this problem, and you have no idea how to deal with these crazy people calling you 100 times a day. So I've written a book that helps individuals understand, you know, how to deal with their collectors, how to deal with their debt problem without necessarily going to a debt settlement company or some other program that may take their money and leave them high and dry.
So is there a website, or how do people find this book and tell us a little bit more about it?
It's actually going to be released through Borders and Barnes & Noble, all the major book chains, shortly. You go in any bookstore and ask for Drop Debt, and they'll be able to get it for you. It's on Amazon and the Barnes and Borders websites.
All right, so let's now talk a little bit about this whole situation. You've raised this whole problem. The phone rings. It's one of these collection agencies. How do you deal with all this?
Well, it's really funny. The big joke we've got is, what do you do when a bill collector calls you 50 times a day? Well, you call them back. The first thing that solves the problem is getting involved in a discussion. You have to talk to your lender. At the end of the day, you owe the guy the money. And if you're correct from the beginning, the money was probably lent irresponsibly. There's some culpability on the part of the bank for sure. The responsible workout comes from the bank providing some sort of concession to you and to you getting on the phone and take responsibility for the fact that you overspent. Often, however, Danny, these problems arise because people have met some economic shock, and certainly in this economy with the unemployment rate where it is and people getting their hours scaled back in terms of, you know, reduced bonuses and reduced overtime, it's amazing to me that more people aren't going down the drain. People have deaths in their family, go through divorces. So when these negative economic shocks come to people, they've got to go call their creditor up and say, hey, I've got a problem.
How willing are the banks, Harvey, to work with you on your credit card debt right now?
Well, that depends on the bank. Now, there are some banks that are really helpful to consumers, and there are some banks that are really, really unhelpful to consumers.
All right. Who are the ones that are helpful?
Are we naming names?
Please.
Well, you know, I think that we've been very happy with B of A. Bank of America is doing a lot to help people with their problems. I think they're doing a lousy job on the mortgage side. That's the reports that I hear. But my experience has been talking to them on the credit card side that they've been pretty good about helping people. Amex has been pretty good about helping people.
And who are the ones that have been less than charitable in helping people,
well, I think
they get TARP bailout money?
I think the biggest problem is, for me, that I've been able to see is Chase Manhattan. J.P. Morgan Chase. Chase is...
That's my bank.
I dated myself from New York. That's funny.
Thanks a
lot. What, Danny?
I said, that's my bank. Thanks a lot. Okay,
well, no.
Tell me about it, you know?
Well, yeah, if Chase has an idea that somehow they can handle a problem, and they don't really realize that there are a range of lenders out there, that the average guy's got about 5 or 6 cards. So, yeah, you know, Chase is working with you on their card while the other 5 banks go down the drain. And typically that results in a lawsuit, and the poor guy goes into bankruptcy. And that's part of, you know, what we're speaking to Congress about and talking to law enforcement about in terms of how banks are engaging consumers in the collection process. Because really, the truth is, Danny, they really want to pay their bill, and they can't. So the question becomes, what do you do to assist them? Do you sue them? You bring them to court and, you know, put them into bankruptcy? Or do you figure out through some, you know, mathematical formula, how do you work this out in some reasonable way? What I'm telling people in the book is the first step to getting it solved is getting on the phone and talking to people.
All right, so let's talk about how to do that. If anyone wants to talk with us, the number here, 888-874-4888. You can also ask Harvey a question if you have an issue about credit card debt. Now, so you want people to call. First of all, how do you get through and talk to a real person, And who is the right person to talk to?
Well, you know, the funny thing is, Danny, you really don't have to call. Just stand by your phone. You'll hear from them. Believe me, you will.
But don't a lot of these banks sell their debt to debt collectors?
Yeah.
And these debt collectors don't really represent the bank. They're trying to get the debt because they get a piece of the action, right?
Well, you get a big piece. Sometimes if the debt is old enough, if it's been charged off over 6 months or a year, it's been sold on the open market for something like, I don't know, 7, 6, 5 cents on the dollar. So when that guy's calling you on the phone and saying, hey, you have to pay us, you know, 100% of what you owe us plus interest plus fees, they are really killing people. And the reason that they're charging so much money is that it's very hard to get people to pay. So much of the universe of debt that they're buying is bad and uncollectible that when they find someone they can collect from, they go for the gusto. They try to take all that they can from that individual. When you talk to somebody on the phone, you want to ask them a question. Did you buy this debt, or do you represent the bank? If they represent the bank, it'll be a tougher discussion. If they've bought the debt, then you can feel confident that somewhere around 20 or 30 cents on the dollar, they're going to be very happy to work it out with you.
Harvey, when you and I spoke last week, you were talking to me about the unprecedented powers banks have. Could you elaborate on that?
I'm sorry, the unprecedented powers of what?
That banks now have.
Right. The banks are just out there issuing edicts to consumer credit counseling and telling the consumer's helper. And this is really the problem, Sherry, and what's happened here is that when consumer credit counseling was organized, I don't know, 4 decades ago to assist consumers, it became very much that they became the bank's helper on a sort of a soft collection basis. That's been going on for years like that. They were helping people to reformat their budgets and get their heads together on how they could pay their debts down, lowering interest rates, abating late fees and over-limit charges. But what's happened is that over the years, the banks, on a voluntary basis of paying quote-unquote fair share, have eroded their support for that system, and unfortunately, credit counseling is becoming less and less and less effective. One of the reasons the debt settlement industry currently exists at all is because banking refused to allow the credit counseling agencies to work with anything less than full balance. What we're advocating now and what we're fighting for is to allow credit counseling to provide less than full balance workouts. Well, the banks are going nuts, Chase in particular, to resist that outcome because they don't want to see, frankly, my read on it is they don't want to see consumers get help. They want to see consumers to continue to not know what to do and to be in a process against professional collection people where a consumer does not have a chance.
Yeah, I mean, I think it has to be pointed out. When I was making In Debt We Trust, I spoke to people in the credit card industry, who told me how much money was invested in market research to try to figure out what people actually know and how to keep them from acting on what they know.
Right.
Essentially to deflect them into other issues, to confuse them as much as possible, to delay them actually paying, because then the charges go up, the interest rates go up, and all the rest of it. Now we have this new credit card reform bill. Can you tell us about that? Is that really going to solve the problem?
Who knows? It's really, really hard to say. I mean, seriously. At the end of the day, we'll find out, won't we? It's like, will the Bankruptcy Abuse Prevention and Consumer Protection Act help? Well, we kind of knew that wasn't going to work. And because the fundamental flaw in it was, the belief was that people don't want to pay their bill. And when that bill was being passed, we said, no, people do want to pay their bill. If you engage consumers and actually talk to them, like civilly, you'll find out that people are basically good. They want to do what they can. They want to do the right thing. They wrote a law. Banks worked for 10 years to pass this law. They wrote a law that said, hey, people are intrinsically bad, and we have to control them. What turned out is that the bankruptcy rate went down for about 4 minutes, and it's back through the roof again like it was before. So what's happened in the market is that people don't want to choose bankruptcy, or they don't want to evade their responsibility. They want to pay what they can. They just cannot. The economy will not support it. They're not in a position to do that. And a credit was extended to them on an unqualified basis. They were pre-approved but not pre-qualified. And that's the problem. Will the CARD Act help? I don't know. We'll see. I really don't know. I wish I had an answer to that, Danny. I honest to God don't know.
Well, I noticed that one of the things it does not do is roll back interest rates. It does not seem to, it increases disclosures of various kinds. But the credit card industry is already working on all kinds of ways to get around, the restrictions by raising fees, by disqualifying more and more people from having credit cards and the like. I mean, it seems to be, there's a battle going on between the promise of regulation, if you will, and the banks that want to resist it.
Well, yeah, and I think at the end of the day, it all comes down to the consumer. The consumer's got to know how to manage their cards. And I don't know about you, but when I was in college, there was no course on plastic. I mean, people like you put out movies like In Debt We Trust. We hope that people will watch those movies and read books, learn how to budget, and understand how to use their credit responsibly. Financial literacy in this country is at a historic low. And, yeah, I mean, when people are extending credit like that to people who don't know how to handle it, well, what's going to happen? You give a kid a car to drive without a license or any training, they're gonna crash into something, and you're looking at millions and millions of car wrecks in the credit card industry and people that are misusing their cards that just don't know how to operate it correctly.
Did you say card wrecks?
Card wrecks, yeah.
I like that.
Card wreck. That's funny.
Harvey, if you could tell the listeners, a lot of people are getting hit with not only extra interest rates, but now the banks are sending credit cards where they're doubling your minimum payment due. How do you negotiate with a bank? If you already can't make your payment to begin with, how are you going to make a double payment with a higher interest rate?
Well, the answer is you're not. And this is the joke in the whole collection process, is that what the consumer can pay is not dictated by their policy or what's on their credit card statement. It's dictated by what's in the person's wallet. And I've been having this debate now for 6 years with the banking industry and collection people, and at the end of the day, they all concede that, you can't get blood from a stone. Well, if that's the fundamental premise of collection, then why isn't a more intelligent approach taken to understanding what the person's fundamental economics are? You can double it. Why not triple it? Why not quadruple it? Why not charge 80% interest? All those issues are irrelevant unless you're in a race to the bottom to take as much money from the consumer as fast as you can before they go to bankruptcy. And for you to get to that money first before the five other lenders that have lent that money get to it. If you can't pay it, and this is the fundamental statement here, call them up and tell them you can't pay it. tell them that we need to make a different kind of plan, and see if they'll help you. In many cases, they will. In some cases, they won't. And then what do? Well, you do what you have to do. You pay your essential bills, you take care of your family, you pay your rent and feed them, and the cards are going to have to go away. And people go, oh, my God, that's going to destroy my credit rating. Well, yes, it is, because obviously you can't handle credit responsibly, and it's time for you to re-educate yourself, let your credit rating go to zero if it has to, until you can get yourself out of debt, and then rebuild your life based on knowledge and financial literacy and manage your money responsibly. Right now you're in a place of disaster, and you have to come out of that place and rebuild. That's just what you have to go through.
So, we're in a situation today where consumers are feeling this debt problem very intensely.
Yeah.
Republicans are feeling or claiming to feel the deficit problem very intensely. it seems as if we have a lot of shoulds going on here. We should do this, we should do that. On the other hand, many people can't do it, as you're pointing out. They've lost their jobs. They've lost sources of income. They've gone through their savings.
Right.
And what are they going to do? And here you have, a very unhelpful situation. How do you get advocates? Should you go and trust these debt settlement companies? What's been your experience with them?
Well, I used to run a debt settlement company. The intention was to, balance the fight. You're up against a professional in the collection industry. They know all the tricks, like you say, and how to get money out of you. They know what to say, how to intimidate you, how to frighten you. You're on the other end of the phone. You've never been in this world before, and you are very unarmed. The idea of the debt settlement companies was to balance the equation. Unfortunately, so many of those companies ended up working in an irresponsible way. They became as crazy as the collection agents, and ultimately were dragging people into these programs that A, should not have been in them, and B, had no idea what the consequences were. Unfortunately, for many of those individuals, their only real solution was bankruptcy. You often hear the claim that it's because of the debt settlement company that I went into bankruptcy. Well, actually, it's because of the fact that you really can't pay your bills and you overextended yourself that you're going into bankruptcy. Could credit counseling have saved many of those people? Typically, those folks already went to credit counseling and didn't qualify for a DMP, for a debt management plan at full balance. And the question becomes, okay, so what do those folks do? Well, as Dr. Manning points out, and has for many years pointed out, that there's a binary there. It's a rock and a hard place. It's 100% or nothing. Well, the debt settlement industry grew up as a rogue industry in the middle of that, saying people want to pay something, they just can't pay at all. So how do we do that? Well, credit counseling can't help them because they don't do that. Now, the Schumer-McCaskill bill called for, in fact, the referrals to credit counseling when people can't pay the full balance. Well, the fact of the matter is that there's no process within credit counseling to accommodate that will. We've met with Schumer staff and McCaskill staff and briefed them on this problem. So there's a very strong movement within credit counseling now to update and modernize credit counseling so that they can actually respond to this debt crisis and provide settlement type programming so that people will be not trapped in debt settlement companies.
Thank you, Harvey. I mean, all this is very bewildering. It's very complicated. On the other hand, it's extremely important. My film, In Debt We Trust, we still have an InDebtWeTrust.com website if you want to know more about it. It's still timely. There have been some changes, of course, since then. Your book, again, the title of it, for people to look out for?
Drop Debt.
Well,
not drop dead, drop debt.
Well, there you go. Harvey Warren, an expert in this field. So thank you so much for coming on today and talking about all this. We wish you all the best luck with your book. I wanted to close the program out today, taking note of the fact that, combat troops are being withdrawn from Iraq. Supposedly peace has broken out in that country. President Obama has claimed a tremendous achievement here. Certainly 100,000 troops have been taken out of Iraq, but the conflict there, the war there, seems to remain in place. And a lot of the people who basically urged that war, who supported that war, who lied about it consistently and continually, are still around, still being quoted, still publishing op-ed page articles in the New York Times and elsewhere. One of particular person who is quoted in the press today about none other than the Lehman Brothers, collapse is a guy named Jim Wilkinson. Jim Wilkinson worked for Hank Paulson, former head of Goldman Sachs, who engineered the bank bailout bill and who basically turned Lehman down in its request for help. And that caused a tremendous ripple throughout the economy. You can read the Times business pages today for more on that. But Wilkinson was also the chief propagandist at the Coalition Media Center in Doha right before the war started. That was the place we tuned in every day for news reporting and basically statements by the government that, in retrospect, were completely dishonest and completely false. So we have to remember the people that lied, the lies they told, and the need to fight for the truth when it comes to war and media. I'll be speaking at City University in London on the 12th through the 13th and 14th. On a conference on war and media to talk more about this. But I wanted to go out today with a song about media wars that we made at the time alongside my film WMD, Weapons of Mass Deception, which was my name for the news media. If you want to reach me, it's dissector@mediachannel.org. The podcast of this show will be available later today on the progressiveradionetwork.com site and also on my blog on Media Channel in the morning. So you can stay in touch with us. Follow me on Twitter, at Dissector Events, on Facebook, if you're interested. Thanks for joining me today. Thank you, Sherry, for being with me. Thank you
for
the guests,
Danny.
I've had. Let's go out with this song to just remember what it was like back then.
We're going to fix that technical problem.
ABC.
NBC.
CBS.
CNN.
Fox News.
Breaking news.
Faking news. It's the media war. It's time to get sore.
This is some kind of bizarre reality TV show.
I worked at ABC News, worked at CNN.
To see so many colleagues, if you will, acting as a megaphone for the military and for the administration.
Thank you, sir.
The Pentagon also controls the timing of bad news, the heavy-handed way of managing the message.
Media war.
Managing the message.
All the networks wanted to have was a countdown to war.
Overemphasis. Overkill.
48 hours to war. Dun, 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 dun. Showdown to Saddam.
The purpose of journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
I thought I answered that.
Media war.
Either with us or you're against us.
The outcome is assured.
Everybody wanted to see Ted Koppel running down the desert in a Hummer.
Based on the Humvee used by the U.S. military, it is one smooth ride. And being so high up above everyone else, everyone gets out of your way. You've got a great view of the road. But that sense of empowerment doesn't come cheap. The Hummer only gets about 12 miles to the gallon.
What about Al Jazeera in that, publishing those gruesome pictures of dead soldiers?
I think there's something that is culturally Arab about that.
You know, I'm looking forward to some tapes of dead people. Osama bin Laden dead, Saddam Hussein dead. I'd certainly put those on Fox News.
And that's Special Report for this time. News. Fair, balanced, and unafraid.
Media war.
Be either with us or you're against us.
Pavlov talked about the power of repetitions. We are getting a message, a media message, that's repeated over and over again. Saddam, Saddam, Saddam. Evil, evil, evil. Saddam, Saddam, Saddam. Evil, evil.
Corporate-owned media is slanted and biased.
What about the issue of challenging the corporate media?
Move on the media. Press the press. I think that the coverage will change. Press the press.
Press the press. Press the press.
Media war.
You're either with us or you're against us. With us or against us.
The whole thing's being treated like infotainment.
The outcome is
this is a spectacle for consumption.
They don't report anything that is in any way critical of Bush.